We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This is the day that we open things up to questions about home maintenance, and we do it every month. We have been doing it for a long time. Scott Spies is here. He's a home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service. And as I like to say sometimes, whatever you have questions about could be basement, attic, windows, doors, siding, insulation, gutters. Maybe I'll just stop. Heating and cooling, whatever kind of question you have. If you have a problem, you're not quite sure how to solve it, you can give us a call. Maybe you're thinking about doing some remodeling, making some changes, thinking about making your house more energy efficient, any and all of that. Give us a call, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And you can also send us questions by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you, David, for having me on.
We're getting some people lined up here. You just suggested that maybe it wouldn't be a bad idea to start a little bit here and start talking a little bit about fireplace safety.
Well, I figure that since we do have the holidays among us here, it's oftentimes we get the family gathering in the fireplace. If it doesn't get used often, this is the one time of year that it might actually get used. So it's always a good idea to practice a little bit of fireplace safety so that we don't have the gentleman in the large red truck show up and make a delivery to the house of a bunch of water. Fireplaces, at this time of year, if you haven't used it, you might want to open the flue if you plan on using it and just double check to make sure we don't have some debris that's fallen in from the top. Make sure we haven't got a squirrel that built a nest in it, things like that, so that it can actually draw and have the flue gases go up and out through the house so we don't end up getting the house smoked back out, the smoke alarms going off, things like that. So, yeah, if you're thinking about having a fire in the fireplace for Christmas, this week would be the time to check it out prior to. Therefore, we can make sure that it's safe for use on Christmas Eve.
Yeah. And the recommendation is certainly that if you have a fireplace and you use it for that to have fires, that the chimney ought to be lined.
Well, the liner on the chimney on a wood-burning fireplace is not as critical as it is on a gas-burning fireplace. The purpose of the liner on the chimney is to protect the mortar and the brick from the acidity of the gas. When we burn gas, we get byproducts, carbon dioxide, sulfur, things like that. And the sulfur and the carbon mix with condensation in the brick, and we can actually create mild solutions of carbonic and sulfuric acids, which in turn eats the brick. With a wood fireplace, we don't get that as much, and we also don't get the condensation because the wood fireplace burns for 3, 4, 5 hours at a time, so the chimney warms up and dries out. Whereas a gas fireplace, of course, you can turn it on and off at will, so you can run it for a half an hour or so. Never really get the flue good and warm. So yes, if you've got a gas log, particularly, I would recommend a liner. Now, if you've got a house that's old, 1920s and before, it's not a bad idea to have somebody do an inspection of the chimney to make sure we don't have any loose mortar, things like that falling out of the chimney that could be partially blocking the flue.
Right. Well, we got several callers. The lines are full, as a matter of fact, so we'll jump right in. First in line is someone in Lafayette, Indiana. This is line number 4. Hello.
Hello. We hear about disconnecting the hose from the hydrant before it freezes. Is it safe to use the hydrant at all in freezing weather, even without the hose?
Okay, well, the outsized hose bibs, yes. If you haven't disconnected it by now, there's a good chance we may have some issues with ice since it has been below freezing for several days. But most, depending on the age of the faucet and the style of the faucet, we have what's known as freeze-proof style faucets. A freeze-proof style faucet, when you turn the handle on the outside, it actually turns a valve about 8 or 10 inches back inside the wall and opens
the
valve.
I've noticed the long stems on those.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So when you turn that off, it closes it off back inside the wall, theoretically back far enough to where we're not going to get any freezing. If you leave a hose on that particular style of faucet, it may not drain. We can still get a freeze action. In other words, if we've got water held up by the outside edge, out by the threads and the hose, we can get an ice block. And, of course, the ice will then start expanding and pushing back against that valve. which will then cause a split in the pipe in that 6 to 8 inches or 8 to 10 inches back into the wall. The
so next can time, I use the hydrant just to wash out a bowl or something?
Yes, because it's designed to drain back inside the wall.
Okay.
Every time you open and close it, yes, it is okay to use. Now, if you have a non-freeze-proof, usually one that has the handle up at a slight angle, usually about a 30 or 40-degree angle instead of being perpendicular to the wall, you'll find that those styles don't have the valve turn off inside the wall, so you either have a shutoff inside the house or they will tend to freeze on the outside.
Well, this is an old house, 60 years, but it says freeze-proof on the hydrant. Those must go back quite a time.
Well, they came out somewhere in the late 70s, so my guess is somebody has replaced them at some point in time.
Replaced them. What do you think about heat cables sitting in the rain gutter?
Well, it's something that's not I don't see on a regular basis, but yes, if you have a ice damming problem or you have an issue where we end up with the gutters blocking up with ice, they do make some heating cables, basically an electric cable with a thermostat that you can lay into the gutter and then plug in, and it will try and keep the gutters warm enough to where we don't get ice blocking up the gutters.
Is that kind marked as to whether it's safe lying in the
Yes,
water?
It's definitely especially designed heat tape. The standard heat tape for plumbing should not be used exterior, so it is a special gutter tape so that it is more protected from the weather and such. The standard heat tape you'd buy for a water line is not UV rated, so the sunlight will tend to deteriorate it.
Thank you, sir.
All right, very good. On to someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
My call is about preventing my pipes from freezing. I just live in a small condo, but I need to know what temperature, how low can I set my thermostat, and are there other things I should do to prevent the pipes from freezing?
Well, I guess I would have to ask, is this something you're talking about leaving for a while, or...
Just for about a week, right.
Okay. Well, in that case, what I would do is I would turn off the water at the water meter. There's usually a main water shutoff valve.
All right.
Okay, you can shut that off. When you do that, you will also want to turn the pilot light off on the water heater.
Okay.
And then you would open one or two of the valves in the house and let the water pressure dissipate. In other words, just leave it open until the water pressure drops and leave those valves open. Generally, if we get a frozen pipe, the pipe does not break at where the ice is, or the ice does not cause the pipe to expand. What happens is we get an ice plug in the pipe, and it starts pushing. As it grows, it starts pushing water both directions. And if it happens to push against a closed valve, the pressure in the pipe will jump significantly as water is not compressible. And so you can get 3,000 or 4,000 pounds of pressure in that line, and that will cause the line to burst. It's not the action of the ice actually expanding in the pipe. It's the fact that as the ice plug gets larger in the pipe, the hydraulic pressure pushing against a pipe tends to burst it. So what you do is you open the valves a little bit. You turn the water off at the main, and then you crack any valve that any faucet that happens to be near an outside wall. And that way, if something does happen where it does get cold, the water doesn't build up pressure. Now, when you come home and turn the water back on, if it did freeze, you may not be able to get water out of that faucet. I do not recommend setting the temperature down in that property lower than 55 degrees.
Okay.
That is, you get much colder than that, we can create all sorts of other problems with the shrinkage of the wood, movement of the plaster, things like that. And you end up with wall cracks, nail pops, other cosmetic items, which... are kind of a nuisance. So, no, I don't recommend any lower than 55 degrees. If you've got a kitchen cabinet or something, a kitchen sink that's on an outside wall, open the cabinet doors so it can allow some of the air from the room to more easily circulate around the pipes.
Ah, okay. That's a whole lot more complicated than I thought. I appreciate your information.
Okay. Thank you for calling in.
All right. Very good. We'll continue and then talk with somebody else in Urbana. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
We were wondering if we should replace our 25-year-old water heater. We don't have any problems with it right now, but we're just figuring there may be some new efficiencies that would make it worthwhile. And I'll hang up and listen.
Well, no, stay
hold,
on the line.
Hold on, hold on.
Don't go away yet. Where is the water heater located?
It's in our basement.
Okay. Water heater in a basement, as far as efficiency goes, you don't need to worry about too much. Most of the, even at 25 years old, most of them had a pretty good insulating blanket around them. The water that we have in Champaign County is very, very good quality water. It is not unusual for me to find water heaters 40 years old or older. As long as the water heater is not doing a thump or a percolating noise, you're probably in pretty good shape. It's not a bad idea to check to make sure it's drafting properly. There's a draft averter, a little angled piece on the top of the water heater. When it fires up, it's supposed to allow some cool air to go up into the flue to pick up the velocity through the flue pipe. As long as you don't feel warm, humid air coming out around that, which would indicate some backdrafting, the water heater is probably working well. What we can end up with, particularly in areas that do not have as good a quality water or in an older water heater, we can get a little bit of sand or sediment built up in the bottom of the tank. Once that sand or sediment builds up in the bottom of the tank, the water doesn't circulate through as well. We burn the burner at the bottom of the tank and heat the water up. If the water can't rise back to the surface, it sits at the bottom until it gets hot enough to boil. When it boils, we get an air bubble going up through the tank, and that air bubble collapses as it goes up to the cooler water. So it really sounds like I call it a thumper, and it really sounds like somebody shaking a box of rocks inside the water heater. At that point in time, the efficiency of the water heater has dropped significantly because it does take more BTUs of heat to boil water than it does to heat water. So at 25 years, I would say probably not replacing it at this point in time unless it's giving you some type of issue. Occasionally we'll get one that has the drip tube corrode or break off. And what that the dip tube, what it does is when you start using hot water, it puts the cold water back in at the bottom of the tank so that you can continue to get hot water out the top of the tank. If that dip tube comes apart or falls loose, you can start using hot water. Next thing you know, the water temperature drops rapidly. It means because the cold water is coming back in the top of the tank, the same place you're taking off the hot water, so you don't have as much hot water available to you. So that is an indication you might want to replace it. But if it's just old, no, I wouldn't say it needs replacement.
All right. Our guest in this hour of focus is Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's here once a month, always on a Monday. We do these shows to help you with home maintenance. And if you have a question, give us a call, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You can send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Next caller is Champaign, and that is line 3. Hello.
Yeah, hi, Scott.
Morning.
Morning. I've got a project lined up today. When I had the house inspected, the house inspector pointed out the inside of the foundation concrete walls, the insulation was off for some reason.
Okay.
And I've got some replacement for that, and it's 1.5 F 250. Is that the proper, is that a good insulation, or is that the proper, I think it's 1.5 inches.
1.5 inches, is it a bead board or an extruded board? What color?
External,
is it?
It's purple.
Okay, you should be all right.
There's
basically two types of foam board. There's an extruded foam board, and then there's a bead board. And the bead board, it looks more like what you'd pick up in your stereo packaging, where it's a bunch of little styrofoam balls that have been compressed together to create a board. And when they do that, you can actually get some moisture in there, and wet insulation doesn't insulate. So you want an extruded board. Usually in this area, it's a pink, a purple, or a blue, something like that. And that is actually a foam that is chemically formed. They spray in a couple chemicals and it expands into the foam board and they cut it into sections. That board is all the air cells are completely enclosed, so there's no water to go through it. And you can glue them to the foundation. I would recommend gluing them probably cover the first 2 feet of the foundation from the sill plate down. Usually that'll get you well below grade. You don't necessarily need to go much lower than that, because anytime you get about 20 or 30 inches below grade, the soil is going to stay about 55 degrees, so it's not as critical. The upper portions are what is exposed to outdoor temperatures.
And my question is, they probably had the wrong kind of glue. They probably used liquid nails, and they probably had to tear the other stuff off because the person at Menards said they probably used the wrong adhesive, and it probably ate through the, and that's probably why they ripped it off. And I still have that, I still have what's left of the glue that was on there. How important is it to scrape that stuff off, or is how important is it to get flush to the foundation brick?
It's not important at all. You can go ahead and go over with another type of glue, and it does help to use a glue that is intended for a foam or a styrene. You can test it before you use it by putting a little dab on an edge or a corner, and if it's going to eat the styrofoam, it'll do it within the first few minutes. The solvents okay. in the adhesives can actually dissolve the plastic, in which case it doesn't stay up very well.
As you mentioned before, when I put it in, it's important to get it up high more than get it lower. I mean,
that is correct. You want it all the way. You want it as high as you can against the. I usually try and butt it up against the termite shield, and then use a fiberglass above that so that it can be removed. So you can check it for moisture, condensation, mildew, things like that. So usually the foam insulation I put up as high as the termite shield, and a 2-foot board will do 3 concrete blocks or 24 inches, which should get you well below your grade line.
Okay, thank you very much, Scott.
All right, very good. On to another caller here, Champaign County, line 1. Hello? Caller there, Champaign County, line 1.
Sorry about that. I went to one of these presentations that had, it was a bit like a circus barker, but it was Light Power Solutions, and I wanted to bounce some of these project or these materials that they were hyping to you. There are 3 things. One of them you've commented before about, which is reflective material for insulating and reflectivity in the attic, and mm-hmm. he was making a big deal out of how it was pure aluminum, and that made it better than just, you know, stapling tin foil up like some people did in the past. Or I think you pretty much dismissed that, except for maybe places where there's really a lot of heat load.
There's definitely some merits to reflective insulation, but if you've got proper amounts of insulation in the attic, it's not as critical. If you've got an area where you are limited into how much insulation you put in there, then it does seem to help. I won't say it doesn't work, but let's just say that the numbers that generally you get from that style of salesperson is the worst case scenario, and the chances of you getting the improvement that he claims you're going to be getting are pretty slim.
Right. The other thing was, I know big buildings do this, but they have a capacitative interface across the mains. The main service, mm-hmm. and they're saying that particularly with the projections of the increase in electric costs, that it'd be good to get one of these things. And I assume if you have a big McMansion with a lot of devices and a lot of machineries, he again illustrated with something called a split phase motor, which I guess probably takes the best advantage of this whatever this thing does to spread out the load. I was also wondering whether an old house that got wired kind of haphazardly through the years might present a kind of an unbalanced load, and that might be another reason why one of these things would actually have some benefit.
Well, okay, I'll be honest that this is not exactly my area of expertise. I've got a pretty basic knowledge of electrical, actually a little bit more than that. But as far as putting a capacitor across the mains, I really don't see much point in it unless, again, as you are indicating, we're using some type of motor loads where we can get one phase or one leg to have a sudden surge where a capacitor would help protect that and give you a purer power.
That's not the theory of it, but I don't understand
okay.
it either, so I can't go any
yeah.
further with that.
Okay,
one.
Well, I'll have to say that that's something you'd want to check with your electrician on. I don't know that it'll help.
The other one is interesting for people, I guess, who might be listening more from places where they don't have gas, but they apparently sell a product that actually retrofits a water heater with what looks like an air conditioning unit, and it's actually a heat pump that they install into an older water heater if it's structurally good.
Okay.
Not full of sand, but it's an interesting concept. But again, if you have, depending on what gas does vis-a-vis electricity, et cetera, I don't understand why it would be good for anybody around here particularly, but maybe, I don't know. It's just a curious device, though, where they actually come in and retrofit your water heater to be to use heat pump, the heat pump to heat it.
Yeah, if you've got a heat pump or you've got a, even a hot water boiler pumped water system, they do make loops or hot water heating systems where your domestic hot water can be heated by the furnace. And
well, that's a different thing. That's a different thing. This is actually a dedicated heat pump that looks, like I say, it looks like the size of an air conditioning unit. And they come in and take, apparently take out the heating core, and they, or I don't know exactly how they do it, but they retrofit your existing water heater with a device that, like I say, looks like a window air conditioner, sets right on top of it, and heats it instead of what you were doing, how you were heating it before that.
Okay, so if you're using electric heat there, you're trying to, they're trying to say that this system is a little bit more efficient electrically.
Right. Right.
Well, again, I'd have to look into it a little bit more. It's not something I've run across.
I
appreciate the call. I have a hard time believing that anything, if it's going to use electricity, it's going to use electricity. Electricity is 100% efficient. If you are using electricity to heat water, 100% of the heat from the electricity is going to heat the water. So using a heat pump system which uses electricity to heat water, it's only going to create so many BTUs of heat. So I'm not quite sure. I mean, I know a heat pump is more efficient than a standard furnace system because it pulls heat from the outside. I'm not sure how you could get one mounted on top of a water heater that is going to draw air from the heat from the house air or from the outside air. So that gives me some homework I can play with for the next month.
Okay.
Which does remind me, next month I am on a little bit earlier. Instead of being on the third Sunday of the month, I'm coming in on the second Sunday of the month. So some of my regular listeners may want to mark it on the calendar. We're going to sneak up a week.
That's right. If you really depend on being able to listen to Scott, that's right. We made a small change in the schedule for January. So do that. Mark that on your calendar. Right now, if you've got questions, Scott Spies is here from the Spies Home Inspection Service. It's our monthly show on home maintenance. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Was there something that you
wanted to mention? Wanting to go back to the original caller from Lafayette who something about the freeze-proof hose faucets. Right. He did bring up some good points. We, of course, do recommend that you disconnect any hoses before freezing weather. If you forgot and it's still attached, I would recommend trying to get it off sometime when it's sunny and the ice may have melted enough to pull the hose off of it. But there are basically two different styles of valves. One is a freeze-proof, which he indicated he had, and usually the handle is basically perpendicular to the wall. In other words, it's the rod that you would turn is straight back into the wall. Mm-hmm. One that has about a 45-degree tilt is not a freeze-proof style, and they usually have a valve that you turn off inside the house that you're supposed to turn off, and then you go outside and open it up and drain all the water out. And that style, of course, you don't use during the wintertime, whereas the freeze-proof you could actually use during the wintertime, turn it back off, and the water is supposed to drain back out. So just wanted to clarify on the two different styles. And I will say that the freeze-proof faucets actually tend to freeze and break more often than the non-freeze-proof. In that the non-freeze-proof, you know, when they freeze, the ice starts forming at the outside and it pushes against the water back inside the house. And usually somebody will flush a toilet or run a water line someplace and reduce the pressure. So it'll freeze to an ice plug to where it won't run water, but it won't necessarily break the pipe. Whereas the freeze-proof style with that valve inside the wall, if you don't drain it, it will actually break the pipe. And then the next spring when you go to turn the water faucet on, the water pressure is about half what you think it should be, and the other half the water is going inside the house someplace.
Yeesh.
So the freeze-proof is actually more of a problem than the non-freeze-proof most of the time.
Okay. We have some callers here, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have some other folks here ready to go. Urbana is up next. That's line one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, I have Formica countertops in my kitchen, and they're 60 years old, and they need replacing because they're worn through some spots.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a person come to look at this, and he says, don't try and take the old one off anyway because you'll just make a mess of the top. Well, I was planning to use a brown paper bag and a hot iron to loosen it and get it off because I've done that with floor tiles I wonder what you, so what would be your, I hate the idea of putting a new one on top of the old one.
You're just talking about doing a new Formica laminate over the top of the existing countertop?
Well, that's what the carpenter wants to do, that wants to do it. He doesn't want me to try and take the old one off.
I don't know why you wouldn't want to take the old one off, because the Formica is simply a very thin layer laminated over the top of a wood form.
Right.
And I've done some extra laminate work for ends and stuff like that, and it's really not all that difficult to do. Getting it, once it's that old, the glue may or may not come off easily.
Uh-huh. Well, it seems like it's loose in some spots.
Well, okay, it can get brittle, but actually it's one of those things where it'll come off in some areas, but where you want it to come off, it's probably really stuck down.
Yeah.
But using a heat gun or something to soften the glue can be a way of peeling it off. And then you might have to go over it with a light sandpaper to smooth off the glue edges, but I don't see that being an issue. Putting the layer of Formica over the top of the existing layer, I think, would be more of a problem. Everything gets built up just a little bit higher. And,
yeah, that's what I don't like.
So I think most people don't bother doing that. It's too labor-intensive. Most of the time they just take the Formica countertops are relatively inexpensive these days compared to the labor that it would take to redo them on-site or to pull them apart on-site. So most people just buy them cut to fit and drop them in place, figuring that the factory can do it cheaper than you can at home.
You mean the whole countertop, the Formica plus the wood that it's on?
Yep. Most of the time they're just replaced as a unit. Because
the whole thing?
Yep.
Oh, boy.
I think you'll find that if you price out the cabinet or the countertop itself, and let's say we're replacing a six foot length or so, and you end up with $120, $130 in the countertop. At today's prices, where people are charging $15 or $20 an hour, the 2 hours it takes to, or 3 hours that it would take to pull the old one off, and then another couple hours to re-laminate it and trim it all back out, you end up with more money and labor than you would have if you'd bought a new countertop.
Well, where do you go to get the new countertop? The lumber yard or where?
Most of the lumber yards or the kitchen and bath appliance places will come out and do measurements and give you free estimates on new countertops.
Okay. Well, that's very helpful then. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. I'd never even heard of that. Just replacing the layer of laminate rather than just ripping off the whole thing and putting a brand new one on.
From a labor-intensive standpoint, if you're paying somebody to remodel a kitchen, generally speaking, it's cheaper to put in a new counter because the amount of time and effort it takes and to get the laminate and get it smooth and get it cut and get the glue down is something that is better done in a factory where we actually have the proper glue spray guns that we can spray a nice even layer of glue down over the laminate. We've got the proper heating systems to heat it and soften things up, whereas doing it in on-site gets a lot messier, you get glue everywhere. By the time you have the extra hours in it, yes, it's usually just as effectively inexpensive to do it by buying new countertops.
Yeah.
But yeah, Formica countertop is merely a thin laminate over the top of a wood form and can be done. I've done it myself where we've had to cut one and taken a new piece of Formica and put some glue on there and put a new end cap on it because it was now shorter than what it came from when we ordered it. So yeah, it can be done. It's something that if you've got the time and are willing to spend the effort doing it, that's great. But like I say, if you're paying a remodel or something like that, for them, it's more cost effective just to purchase new countertops completely.
Yeah. Okay, let's go on here. We'll talk with someone in Champaign, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I had a question about continuing your questions about water heaters. In Champaign here, do you suggest that we annually should open the drain plug and drain them out or not?
Not usually. Really, we don't get a lot of lime and mineral buildup in the bottom of the tanks. I will admit the final filter for the water company is a sand filter, and if somebody's done a lot of water main work near you, you can get a little bit. But most water heaters in this area, they do not end up draining them. If you're in a rural area, you're in someplace that doesn't have the municipal softening system, we can get a lot of debris in there. And, yes, they do recommend that once a year you take and flush the water system out so we don't end up with that sediment at the bottom. But in this area, I find that it's usually not necessary.
Oh, I used to do it, but then I had trouble with the shutoff valve.
That's usually what happens. Is the drain valve that we have on them nowadays is all plastic, and generally you get just a little bit of debris in that drain valve, and it doesn't shut off. So then you've got to drain the whole system and unscrew the drain valve and install a new drain valve rather than just flush the unit. So,
that's good. I also remember one time when I didn't disconnect my hose when it froze, and then my I turned the water on and nothing came out, but I heard it running and it was a broken pipe under the crawl space. So I'm pretty careful now. Make sure and take the hoses off the things and leave the faucets.
Well, I would have to say that's one of my embarrassing points also is I went out one day when it was 60 degrees and washed my truck, and the next morning it was 30, and I'm like, oh, I better disconnect that hose.
And the water's running, but why is none coming out of the faucet, you know?
Look down the hose and say, why is it dribbling out? And then you realize that you're paying to fill your basement or fill your crawl space with city water.
Thanks a lot for your help. I appreciate it.
Very good. Right. Thank you. Other questions, again, are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. We had a caller also, the guy who was asking about the possibility of putting whether there was a particular kind of heat tape or heating cable that you would put in your gutters to keep things from freezing so you don't have the problem of ice damming. Now, I guess I had not heard of that, but I know that there are places where they have a kind of a heating tape that people put under the shingles right at the edge of the roof that essentially is supposed to do the same, have something of the same function.
Generally, the heat tape on the shingles is for an area where we don't have a gutter or something to catch the snow, so it tends to slide off on, down in front of an entryway. It's usually more on a contemporary style home where they have little or no gutter or little or no overhang. But it's also to help reduce ice damming. Most of the time when we have ice problems in a gutter area or on a soffit area, it's an indication that we've got too much heat loss in the house. If the attic is properly ventilated, it should be very close to ambient outdoor temperatures. So therefore, when it snows and it's below freezing, the snow should sit on the shingles and not necessarily melt. If we don't have enough attic ventilation, the heat from the house comes up, warms the attic, the snow on the roof melts, runs down. When it gets out to the soffit area or the overhang, there's no more house air coming up because the overhang's not over the living area, and so we tend to refreeze. It's a little bit colder, so it tends to freeze on the shingles or freeze in the gutters. So the first thing I like to do when somebody calls me and says, hey, I've got a lot of ice damming, I've got gutters blocking up and things like that, the first thing I like to do is look in the attic and see how much insulation we've got. Make sure we haven't got a heat duct that's come disconnected or something that's warming the attic, creating this the melting problem that is then going out to the sides or out to the overhangs and refreezing. Now, some types of construction, cathedral ceilings, things like that, places where we can't get additional insulation in, so we do end up with a snow melt, then yes, they do make a couple different heating tape systems. They make a wire that you can zigzag on the shingles or put under the shingles. They make one you can lay down into the gutter area. And of course, they do make heating systems that go underneath driveways so you don't have to shovel your driveway. All sorts of different things. All depends on how much this is really a problem and how much of it really bugs you that you want to take care of. And actually, in Illinois, we're a pretty good candidate for most of that. Once you start getting farther up north, it is so much colder so much more of the time that a lot of times the heating systems just aren't adequate. So right in this area is the zone where a lot of those auxiliary heating systems will actually be functional.
Yeah. So you can have a heated driveway, huh?
You can have a heated driveway so that the driveway melts off all but on its own so you don't have to shovel it.
Pretty good. All right. If you had a really long driveway, that might be something you might want
to thinking
have.
If you've got enough money to spend on the heating bill, that's a perfectly good way of going. Mm. Personally, I'm turning the thermostat down in my house, so I'd be darned if I'm going to turn one up in the driveway.
Well, you've got a snowplow on your truck.
There you go. I got a snowplow.
All right. A couple of callers here, both in Urbana. Line one is next. Hello. Line one or Ben? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I want to add another layer of insulation in my attic, And I know it doesn't have a vapor barrier on the ceiling. It already has five and a half inches of cellulose blown in. And so I'm going to put level that off and put fiberglass over top of that.
A loose fill or a bat?
A bat, I think.
Well,
and
before you do that, you might want to do some price shopping.
Okay.
I have found on my own house that it was less expensive for me to pay somebody to come in and blow insulation in than it was to go out to one of the do-it-yourself stores and buy the insulation and do it myself.
Really?
They can buy the installers can buy the insulation cheap enough that they pass the savings on to you. And it was good. When I did my attic, I went out to one of the do-it-yourself stores, priced out the insulation. And it was $310 worth of insulation. I'm figuring, okay, a couple of pizzas and some beer for some friends to help out. And I had one of the contractors in town come out and do it for $265. And no, he didn't know who I was, so it wasn't like he was trying to give me a good deal. So it would have cost me $45 plus a couple extra pizzas to do it myself than it was to hire somebody to do it.
And stay out of the attic.
And I didn't have to climb up in there and wear a respirator and everything else. So you might want to get some prices before you just run out and say, gosh, this is a do-it-yourself thing, let me do that. You might want to get some prices and find out that you can save money by not doing it yourself.
Now, you don't see a problem with it? It was built without a vapor barrier. You don't see a problem there?
Well, hopefully we don't have so much moisture in the house that we need to add one now. I mean, if you've got condensation on windows and things like that, then we need to worry about where the water source is. Generally speaking, you could install a vapor barrier. A vapor barrier will work as long as there's more than 5 or 6 inches of insulation over the top of it. So if you were to put one down now and then add another 5 to 6 inches of insulation, it wouldn't be catastrophic. You're not going to end up with a lot of condensation in there. Generally, if they don't add the vapor barrier during construction, I don't worry as much about it, and particularly since you indicated you do have some cellulose insulation. The cellulose insulation is... it packs a lot tighter than the fiberglass insulation, so it does reduce the amount of moisture that tends to move through it. I won't say that cellulose insulation is a vapor barrier, but it does slow down the water movement through it because it does pack a lot tighter than the fiberglass.
Okay, thank you.
All right, very good. And another caller here. This is also Urbana, line two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah.
I was calling... two related issues. I have some humidity problems in the house, and without running, wanting to continually be running air during the summertime, I'm going to be in the process of having my house reshingled, and I was wondering, would a ridge vent potentially assist with airflow in the house and maybe help out with the humidity problems in the house?
Okay, are we talking lack of humidity or excessive humidity?
Extensive humidity, yeah. In corners of the house, I've actually had some mold growth relative to the humidity being too high. And I try not to run the air a lot during the summertime, but if that is the only solution to lowering the humidity, that's what I'll do. But I was wondering, would a ridge vent potentially help?
Well, ventilation in the attic is always a good thing, particularly if you've got condensation inside the house. Chances are you've got condensation in the attic area. So, yes, ventilation is, of course, a good idea. I would be more concerned on finding where the water source is. Where is this moisture coming from? In order for water to condense on anything, we have to have high humidity in the house. We don't get high humidity accidentally. Something is putting water into the house. Now, whether or not you've got four aquariums going, or you're growing lily pads in ponds in the basement, I've seen all sorts of, and those are not just out of the blue. I've actually found this type of thing in basements, which is why I mentioned them.
I'm sitting on a slab, so I'm kind of hard. Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, is there a humidifier already on the furnace?
Yes.
Okay, and could it be that you're not setting it correctly?
Yeah, I during the summertime, I do not. I set it pretty low.
It actually should be off. It should not have any power to it at all in the summertime.
Okay.
It should only operate in the wintertime. I have found where the electronically controlled valve for the humidifier gets a little bit of dirt in it. It doesn't close completely, so it does continually add moisture.
Okay.
So it's one of those things where you may have to actually shut the water off. And I even did have one last year where I had a customer say, I've got water in the windows. I went over there and said, well, you probably have the humidifier set in correctly. So I turned off the water to it, and they called me back a couple weeks later, and they still had problems. And I'd pulled the water line off, and the valve that I'd shut off didn't shut off completely. The valve in the humidifier didn't shut off completely. So no matter what we did, it was always adding more moisture. I finally ended up crimping it shut and soldering it. And lo and behold, 2 days later, the house dried out.
Okay.
If you're not running an air conditioner in the house during the summertime, you probably want to consider getting a dehumidifier and putting it anywhere in the house. It doesn't matter where, preferably over a drain so you don't have to empty it, and just let it run. And that will work as far as reducing the moisture levels in the house.
Okay. But overall, in terms of circulation, a ridge vent is really not the way to go?
Well, a ridge vent is very good for attic ventilation. And the more we ventilate the attic, the drier the house will tend to be. But most of the train of thought is, if you have a condensation problem in the attic, the first thing you do is add more ventilation. And I like to say that ventilation is a solution to a symptom, not a solution to a problem. If you've got condensation in the attic area, the problem is we got too much moisture in the house. Where's it coming from?
If you're sitting on a slab, though, the source of the water is someplace in the house, as you indicated, an aquarium or some source of water in the house, more than likely. It's not coming up from the foundation.
Well, hopefully when they put the slab down, they put a sheet of plastic or a vapor barrier underneath the concrete slab.
Okay.
I have found where we've had holes in heat ducts, and so that if you don't get your guttering, your drainage around the outside, they've actually filled the heat ducts in the slab full of water. The furnace kicks on, and it sounds like it's gurgling. That will definitely fog every window in the house almost immediately.
Okay.
There are several different moisture sources. Bathroom vent fans that don't run to the outside. You take long hot showers, they're not vented out. A water heater or furnace that do not vent properly will create a lot of moisture problems. Any unvented gas appliance, such as a gas range with a non-vented hood. Anytime you burn gas, one of the byproducts is a water vapor.
Oh, geez. Okay.
So there are a lot of sources. Anytime you have any gas-burning appliances, you want to make sure that they are vented properly outside. If you've got a range and you have some type of vented hood to get that out, I like to put my bathroom fans on timers so I can set them for 30 minutes or 40 minutes. Take my shower, let the fan run after I'm done to pull the excess humidity out of the house.
Wow. Okay.
If you've got mold and mildew in corners, it may be a lack of insulation. You've got really cold corners.
Okay.
So going into the you say a slab, so we can't go into the crawl space and add any more insulation. How old's the house?
About 50, 60 years old.
Okay. It's possible we've got some missing insulation in the corners. There usually a couple of the insulation companies here in town have these infrared cameras.
Okay.
Basically handheld units that they can take and point at a wall and give you a color picture of it, much like we'd see on CSI type shows.
Yeah.
And that shows you where the cold spots are, and they can say, hey, we've got no insulation in this corner. So your condensation may be the fact that that section of wall is 22 degrees, and there's just nothing you're going to do about it. You're going to have moisture there, in which case the only thing we can do is worry about taking the drywall and adding some insulation. So there's several different things we can do. A ridge vent, I'm not going to say it's not going to help. A ridge vent is a good idea. I like attic ventilation.
Okay.
But it may not be the cure-all.
Okay. And do they, and quickly, I'm sorry, do they come with certain liabilities that I should be aware of if I should get a ridge vent installed?
Generally speaking, no. I haven't found any of the designs here lately that have caused a lot of problems. Initially, when the ridge vents came out, not all of them had a wind deflector, and so it was possible to get a little bit of snow and ice blowing in through them, or even some rain and get some water up in the attic areas. But most of the new ones nowadays, we don't seem to have that problem. They've pretty well worked that out.
Okay. Fantastic. Thank you very much.
All right. Very good. Thank you. Well, I have an email from here that I want to get in from a listener who says, as I look out the window and see it snowing again, in capitals, I'm reminded that my central air conditioner cover blew away during recent high winds. While searching the neighborhood for it, I noticed most of my neighbors had uncovered units. And the listener wants to know, well, how important is it that I cover the unit for the winter? And apparently this is the second one that she's had this experience with, one being blown away. So do you need to cover that outside unit?
As a general rule, no. Matter of fact, I've actually seen covers create problems. If you're going to cover the air conditioner, it needs to be a breathable fabric, something that can't hold moisture. In other words, you don't wrap it in plastic. Because then it will hold moisture and you'll actually rust the fan and the get moisture in the armature and things like that, rust the case. So most of the time they are designed to be exposed outdoors, and you know, unless you've got an overhang that is dripping icicles and it's just turning it into one big frozen block, a little bit of snow and ice is not going to hurt it.
Okay.
So I would say that I wouldn't lose sleep over not having a cover on it. Mine does not have a cover on it. If it's someplace directly underneath the downspout and every time the gutters overflow or get icicles coming down, you've got this 3-inch layer of hard ice over the top of it, yeah, that's probably not a bad idea to put something over it, because ice expanding and contracting can actually bend or damage things. But if it's just if it's out where it's getting a little bit of snow on it, no, I probably would not cover it.
So then if you were going to cover it, were you just talking about something that would protect the top, or are you talking about something that would actually go over it, as long as it was maybe made out of canvas and not
a canvas
plastic
or a cloth or something like that, you could put over the top of it and it'll keep the snow and ice from getting on it. But generally, the paints that we're using nowadays for sealing things like that are a much better quality. The metal that they're using is usually treated so that it doesn't rust. Then they put on a baked on finish. So most of the time, the paint will last as long as the unit itself.
All right. Well, again, we have maybe about 5 minutes left in this Bar to Focus with Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's on the program once a month. We talk about home maintenance, and if you have a question, you can give us a call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Someone calling here from Rosemont, Illinois, on our toll-free line. We'll go right there. Line four, hello.
Hi there.
Yeah, hi.
I had a question concerning movement and the foundation. I'm starting to see some of my walls down in the basement starting to crack from a lateral shift. And also, like, on my garage, on the right side of the garage door, I know that portion of the foundation is starting to move. What I call a structural engineer or a waterproofing company, who would best be able to evaluate the situation?
Well, a structural engineer, of course, is the top of the line answer you're going to look for. They're going to be able to tell you absolutely everything. You might want to start with a home inspector, somebody that is familiar with your area and the soils and stuff, because they've seen other houses. They might have a couple of good ideas. You're saying you're getting some movement. Is this is it an inward movement or is it a vertical movement?
I am noticing additional cracks within the interior walls, I'm getting a vertical movement on the foundation next to the garage door, where I'm starting to see a gap between the door itself and the garage door.
So at the slab or at the foundation? I mean, is the slab dropping or is the foundation wall moving?
The one side of the slab is dropping, and I'm also seeing the vertical wall starting to pull away, where I'm now seeing the light coming through the right side of the garage door.
Okay. And is this a poured concrete or a concrete block?
Poured.
Because some type of cracking is common in a poured concrete. When they pour concrete, of course, it comes off a truck wet, and they pour it in place, and we do get some normal shrinkage cracks. Now, a shrinkage crack is a relatively small crack and doesn't appear to have much movement. If you actually see it wider at the top or bottom, or if it's got a shift in it vertically, then we may have some settlement problems. One of the things – go ahead.
Why would this occur? The house is now 25 years old, and this is starting to become a problem now. It was never an issue before now.
So you're seeing cracks that you are pretty confident are new cracks.
Correct.
Because I know a lot of times somebody sees a crack and they start looking, and all of a sudden they're starting to find cracks that they've really been there for quite a while, and they just never really paid much attention. Without seeing that, I couldn't tell you what kind of movement we've got. Most of the time in Illinois, if we've got movement, it's because the soil around the outside of the house expands and contracts with different moisture content. Make sure your downspouts are extended out and such, so we're not saturating corners or holding a lot of water next to the foundation.
Well, I know that is becoming a problem, so
yeah,
those areas up.
Probably for that situation to figure out exactly what our issue is and what kind of movement is occurring, a home inspector would probably be a good place to start.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your help.
All right, very good. Well, we have about a minute or so left. Any last sort of thing, particularly that be seasonal, that you might want to mention?
Well, of course, so we already discussed the fireplaces. Of course, I did a house inspection the other day. The storm windows still were not closed, so you might want to check and make sure your storm windows are closed and latched to help keep out old man winter as the cold air does start to work its way through the house and things start drying out. Hopefully, at this point in time, it's been cold long enough. We don't have a lot of condensation problems on the windows. Usually, the very first one or two cold hits, we get high humidity. And I get a bunch of phone calls about people looking for moisture problems. But by this time of year, you shouldn't have them. So if you've got water condensing on your windows now, we do have excess humidity in the house, and it's not just a seasonal change. Probably a good idea to look for it for the moisture source.
Yeah. And if you don't we talked to somebody earlier who had a power humidifier on their furnace, which can be a problem. But if you don't have that, maybe one thing that you might want to think about is if you have gas appliances, furnace, water heater, you need to make sure that those are venting properly.
Yes. Yeah. And if you do have a power humidifier, you got to remember that when the temperature drops below 10 or 15 degrees, you need to turn that temperature, the thermostat or the humidistat down a little bit, in that the humidistat setting at 30 degrees is way too much moisture at 5 or 10 degrees, because we're talking about relative humidity, relative to outdoor humidity. And when it's cold as heck outside and it gets down to zero, there's not a lot of moisture out there. So you don't need a lot more in the house to be relatively high. Mm-hmm. So the humidifier should be reset with different outdoor temperature changes.
Okay. Scott Spies from the home from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's with us once a month. And let's see if we got this one right. Usually the third Monday. January, it's going to be
the second Monday.
All right. Mark that on your calendars. Hey, thanks very much.
All right. Well, thank you. And everybody have a happy holiday.